pointing to the piece of paper. "Mandatory and statutory training," she said. "It was a complete and utter waste of time. It was only bearable because some of your colleagues were there and spent the whole time taking the piss out of the lecturer, who was completely useless. I was told afterwards his background was in catering. He didn't know anything he was talking about. He'd just been trained to say it. You're going today. Have you forgotten?" she added in a mockingly disapproving voice. "It's mandatory for all members of staff, and that includes consultant surgeons." "Oh, really?" I replied. But it was true that I had received a letter from the chief executive a few weeks earlier. The letter stated that it had been brought to his attention that I had not attended mandatory and statutory training, and that it was indeed mandatory and statutory that I attend. The fact that he had found the time to write to me showed that the MAST course was clearly of vital importance. So I walked out of the hospital into the late August sunshine and made my way across one of the hospital's many car parks, narrowly missed being run over by a long line of wheelie bins being tugged around the perimeter road by a bored-looking man on a small tractor, and presented myself to the Training and Development Centre, a large and flimsy mobile home, the floor of which shook as I strode angrily down the corridor to the room where the MAST seminar was to be held. I was late, and there were already about 40 people sitting glumly at desks, a mixed group of nurses, cleaners, clerks and doctors, and doubtless other members of the huge bureaucracy that forms an NHS trust. I took a chair and sat in the far corner at the back. The lecturer, a young man with a trim ginger beard and shaven head, came and presented me with a folder entitled MAST Workbook. I felt as though I was back in school, and I refused to take it from him. So, with a sigh, he patiently left it on the floor beside me and returned to the front of the room and turned to face his audience. The seminar was scheduled to last 3 hours, and I settled down to get some sleep. The long hours I worked as a junior doctor in the distant past have taught me the art of getting to sleep virtually anywhere on any surface. Halfway through, there was a coffee break before we were to learn about fire drill and the principles of customer care. As we walked out of the room, I picked up a message on my mobile phone, which I had dutifully turned off. One of my patients on the women's ward was dying, and the ward sister had rung to say that the family wanted to talk to me. So I returned to the hospital and went up to the ward. The patient in question was a woman in her 40s with breast cancer, who had developed a secondary tumour in her brain. This had been operated on and removed by one of the senior trainees a week earlier. But 2 days after the operation, which had gone uneventfully, she had suffered a major stroke. She was now dying. I had realized earlier in the week, with something of a shock, that nobody had spoken to the family about this. The surgeon who had done the operation was away on leave, as was my own registrar. I had been busy operating, and none of the small army of shift-working junior doctors had felt sufficiently involved with the patient, whom they did not know, to talk to the family. I had therefore arranged to meet them at 9 in the morning, forgetting that I was supposed to be attending the MAST seminar. I found the patient's husband, an elderly mother, sitting sadly beside the woman's bed, squeezed into the narrow space between her bed and the next patient's in a 6-bed bay. She was unconscious and breathing heavily and irregularly. There were 5 other patients in the room, with only 2 feet or so between their beds, who could watch her slowly dying. I hate breaking bad news to patients and their families in rooms like this, overheard by others, hidden by a flimsy curtain. I also hate talking to the patients and their families, customers, as the trust would have it, while standing. But there were no empty chairs in the bay, so I stood unhappily above the dying woman and her family as I spoke to them. It seemed inappropriate to sit on the bed. Besides, I believe it is now banned by infection control. "I'm very sorry I didn't talk to you earlier," I began. "I'm afraid she suffered a stroke after the operation. The tumour was stuck to one of the major arteries for her brain, and when this happens, even though we are able to remove the tumour, sometimes a stroke occurs in the artery a few days later. The husband and mother looked at me silently. "What will happen?" her elderly mother asked. "Well," I said, hesitating, "I think she will probably..." I hesitated again and dropped my voice, acutely aware of the other patients listening and wondering whether to use one of the many euphemisms for death. "I think she will probably die, but I just don't know if it will be within the next few days or take longer." Her mother started crying. "It's every parent's worst nightmare to outlive their children," I said. "She was my only child," her mother replied through her tears. I reached out to put my hand on her shoulder. "I'm so sorry," I said. "It's not your fault," she replied. There was nothing else to be said, so after a while I went to find the ward sister. "I think Mrs. T is dying," I said. "Can't we put her in a side room?" "I know," the sister said. "We're working on it, but we're desperate for beds at the moment and we'll have to shift an awful lot of patients around." "I'm at the mast meeting all about customer care this morning," I said. The ward sister snorted. "We just give such crap care now," she said with feeling. "It used to be so much better." "But the patients are always telling me how good it is here," I said, "compared to the local hospitals." She said nothing and hurried away, forever busy. I returned to the Training and Development Centre. The second session had already started. The PowerPoint presentation now showed a slide with a long list of the principles of customer service and care. "Communicate effectively," I read. "Pay attention to detail. Act promptly." We were also advised to develop empathy. "You must stay composed and calm," Chris, the lecturer, told us. "Think clearly and stay focused. Your emotions can affect your behaviour." How strange it is, I thought, as I listened to him talking, that after 30 years of struggling with death, disaster, and countless crises and catastrophes, having watched patients bleed to death in my hands, having had furious arguments with colleagues, terrible meetings with relatives, moments of utter despair and of profound exhilaration, in short, a typical neurosurgical career, how strange it is that I should now be listening to a young man with a background in catering telling me that I should develop empathy, keep focused, and stay calm. As soon as the signing-out register had been passed around and I had signed it, thus confirming that the trust could now state that I had been trained in empathy and self-control and the classification of abuse and of fire extinguishers, in addition to many other things I had already forgotten, I charged out of the room despite Chris's protests that he had not yet finished. Next morning, while I was telling Gail about my training, a junior doctor came to the door. He looked anxious and unhappy. He was one of the doctors on the neurology ward, a ward for people with illnesses of the brain who do not need surgical treatment. These are illnesses like multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's disease, or strange and obscure diseases, sometimes untreatable, which neurologists find deeply fascinating, and which they collect like rare butterflies and report in their journals. "I'm sorry to interrupt you," he began. "Not at all," I replied, pointing to the piles of notes and paperwork on my desk and on the floor around me. "I'm only too happy to be distracted. We admitted a 59-year-old woman over the weekend with progressive dysphagia and then fits, and on the scan it looks as though she's got ADEM. "ADEM doesn't sound very surgical," I said. "Acute disseminated encephalomyelitis," he replied. In other words, a sudden and catastrophic inflammation of all of the brain and spinal cord. I told him that I didn't think surgery would be much help. Yes, but